Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Mac, and you are listening to Mac's Musings, hopefully. I'm having a lot of trouble getting my international call, so I'm going to have the guest call in, and hopefully that will work. Usually that doesn't work for Blog Talk Radio, and hopefully he'll be calling in a minute. I let him know that I'm ready. And his name is John Kerrigan, and most of you know him. He's done lots of things. He's a big deal in the martial arts community. He has a martial arts school. I'm just talking to cover some time while he tries to call in, and it might not work for him either. So anyway, he's been in the practicing martial arts for about 50 years, and he has the rank of master instructor in Jeet Kune Do, and he has 2 Martial Arts Hall of Fame awards, and he has his own martial arts school and is a full-time martial arts instructor. And I think this is him, hopefully. Hopefully this is him. Hopefully
hello.
This is working. Hello, John?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Yeah, it wouldn't let you in at first. This place sucks, this block radio. So I had to do a couple different things to get it to work to let you call in. It was terrible. Okay, yeah. So we'll just... So thank you for calling in.
Okay.
Sorry to make you have to do that.
It's right.
And well, how are
it,
you doing?
It,
oh, I'm sorry,
is
what?
It Cheryl or Cheryl?
Cheryl, or you can call me Mac, either one.
Okay, Cheryl, that's fine. Over to you.
Okay, yeah, it doesn't matter to me. How are you doing tonight?
Fine, thank you. No, the drama is out the way of would we ever talk or
yeah,
not.
Yeah, really. So very, very sorry about that.
Don't worry.
Now, I said most of this while I was waiting for you to call, but I'm going to go over it again because it'll give you an idea of where I got my questions from. I was telling them that you've been training for like 50 years in martial arts, that you have a master instructor rank in Jeet Kune Do, and you have 2 Martial Arts Hall of Fame awards. You run your own martial arts school, and you're a full-time martial arts instructor. Now, the 2 questions I have, and you can embellish on them however you want. Did you start with martial arts as a young child, and what prompted you to open up your own school?
Yes, well, all these stories of my life are quite interwoven. So if you don't mind if I go off on a tangent for a moment, I'll explain and you'll understand why. My mother and father were together from the age of 4 years of age, and they grew up together, went to school together, and they got married. They had my sister, and when she was 6 years of age, they had me. And I was, I think, eight weeks old, lying on this sofa. My father went over to my mother. They'd been together forever. He stroked her hair and all of a sudden started smashing her head in with a poker. Boom. That was schizophrenia had taken him over with no warning whatsoever. She fought him off down 4 flights of stairs. He hit her head 18 times with a poker, blood splashing up the walls and all this stuff. He thought he'd killed her, and then he tried to kill himself by slashing his wrist, and she survived. And because she loved him so much, she didn't commit him forever to a prison or a hospital. But that began our life of police sieges, straitjackets. He was a lovely man. His name was Harry. One moment he was lovely. The next minute he was the other side of Harry. This crazy person would step in and take over. So because I was a virtual prisoner for quite a few years with my father, in the end, the nice side of him realized what he did to me and what he was doing to me, making me so introverted. I was overweight and I was timid. So he enrolled me in a martial arts school, take me along and watch me train, and then drive me home again. And that that really began my martial arts training all those years ago, you know, when I was 13 years of age. So the motivation for that, what my father did for me, he was also the catalyst. He was like as if I was like the phoenix rising from the flames. The same side of him saw what he did to me, and he knew I needed something else to give me strength from inside. And before that, my escape was Star Trek. I used to escape into Star Trek, sit in my room and hear him crashing the place up upstairs. And my escape was my cardboard Captain Kirk chair. And my life, really, have been involved with following Star Trek and following Bruce Lee. I became an instructor in Bruce Lee's school. And I used to have two pictures on the wall. One was Captain Kirk in his chair, and the other one was Bruce Lee. And I used to say to anyone who would listen, one day I'm going to push that button on Captain Kirk's chair and be an instructor in Bruce Lee's school. And all my rich uncles and aunts, oh, used to say, yeah, of course, you're as poor little boy, he's as mad as his father is. And, that's what began my martial arts training. And eventually, I not only did both those things, I pushed the button on Captain Kirk's chair, I became an actor in Star Trek, Eugene Roddenberry, I now look after William Shatner, and I became a master instructor in Bruce Lee's school. So nothing is impossible. And I didn't set out to be a martial arts instructor. It was just a natural progression because I saw other people going through what I was going through. And the martial arts was an amazing way to bring your strength from inside you and help in everyday life, not just combat. Sorry, that took a long explanation, but that's the story.
Oh, no, not at all, because, you know, I wanted to hear what it was about. That's why I asked. And one thing I do have to tell you, because I scheduled for 90 minutes, but they took the extra 30 off and put us back to 60. And I just now saw that on the counter. So just letting you know. So I'll have to, like, streamline now that I didn't have it streamlined before. But I'm pretty good at it, so it should work out okay.
Just go with the flow, Cheryl. I'm sure we will. Go with the flow.
Okay. Now, I know that you provided close protection for, you know, a bunch of high-profile people. And but most likely things have changed because of the pandemic. But I did want to ask you about, of course, being the close protection for Captain Kirk himself, Mr. William Shatner. So include how that all came about, how you got that gig, and I'm sure that everybody listening would want to hear about that.
Absolutely. Well, like many people of my age and era, I grew up loving Star Trek, you know, but it was impossible to get to these people, especially living in England. If you're in America, where you are, you've got more access to them. But to me, it was totally impossible. And it was amazing to me when I saw one of those at the Star Trek convention, George Takei was a guest and Jimmy Doom was a guest. And it was like, wow, these people are actually flesh and blood. My connection with Star Trek continued through all the years. I met Gene Roddenberry. Gene inspired me to become an actor. And I made loads of connections in front of the camera and behind the camera. Walter Koenig's been a friend of mine for years. Mr. Chekhov, he stayed at my home. I've stayed at his home. And a guy called James Corley. Lots of you may have heard of James. Before J.J. Abrams came along with his reboot of Star Trek, James had always had the ambition of rebooting Star Trek, the original series. So he built some amazing sets, recreated those sets. And a friend of mine, Doug Drexler, loads of you will know who Doug Drexler is, Doug contacted me and said about James was looking for a lead strong Klingon. So cut it long story short, I went and did, I think, 7 episodes of Star Trek New Voyages, working alongside Walter Koenig, George Takei, many people from classic Star Trek. And James then couldn't do the Star Trek series. It wasn't taken up as a series, but his amazing sets became a museum. He got the license to have the world's only classic Star Trek museum with all recreations of the sets down to the last detail in upstate New York. And I kept contact with James. And then one day he contacted me and said, William Shatner is coming to see my sets. John, could you, you know, I trust you with all your martial arts. Could you be Bill Shatner's security? Now, Captain Kirk was always a hero of mine. The Bruce Lee and Captain Kirk connection, they were role models of mine, because my father couldn't be. But I'd always heard these stories about Bill Shatner. My friend Walter Koenig, unfortunately, fell out with Bill. George fell out with Bill, and they didn't like him anymore. And I thought, wow, you know, my hero, Captain Kirk, will it be a disappointment? Will it be an awkward situation? Will Bill even look at me, you know? And so I was full of trepidation, but I flew over to upstate New York to look after him because that's, I wanted him safe, and James knew I could do the job, especially in the current climate where, you know, with the politics of your lovely country, it's so divided and there's lots of, you know, passions about.
Yes.
So I flew over to the sets in upstate New York to look after Bill Shatner, and I met him at the airport. And because we were in the car in the SUV, and he turned around to look at me, and I said, well, Bill, in case you're wondering who I am, I've just flown in from England to look after you. I have trained in the martial arts for nearly 50 years, and they know I'll be safe with you. You know, I'll look after you. And that was it. Bill Shatner loves martial arts. And we just hit it off like a house on fire. He opened up, and we went for dinner. We went for drinks. And then when we got to the sets in Ticonderoga, we went on the engineering set, and he asked, takes questions from the audience. And one guy said, oh, Mr. Shatner, why was there lots of fight scenes in the engineering section on the Enterprise? And Bill was standing there in the middle of the engineering. He said, well, there was lots of space. And they looked around and said, where's John? And he beckoned me over, and he said, well, John's a martial arts expert. He said, but who thinks I can kick John's ass because I'm Captain Kirk? And I was like, what? And he looked at me and went, go with it. And then he just started to attack me like Captain Kirk, and I went with it. And I got beaten up by Captain Kirk. And it was amazing. He helped me up and round of applause. And every time, I've been over there for 3 years doing this, and multiple tours of these sets, every time we get into engineering, he turns around and attacks me and beats me up as Captain Kirk. So it was beyond my wildest dreams that that would happen. But the serious side of it is, you know, I never drop my guard because I'm there to look after Mr. Shatner. And we've become friends. I never thought I would. But to me, it's like a sacred trust. You know, if you care for someone, then you put your life on the line. And that's part of the job I do. I do close protection and looking after, well, Captain Kirk. What could be better? Even if it beats me up, you know?
Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, I knew all these things about you, but, you know, I have to ask for the listeners. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's a very wonderful story about, you know, him and how you were worried about if he was going to even be nice to you, and he ended up becoming a friend.
Well,
and still your hero, and you still get to protect him. I'm sorry, go
ahead. I'm sorry to cut across you. It's a delay. He signed one of his books to me. During our time together, he said to me, John, kicking your ass, you'll have no ass left. Right? So he signed the book. Signed the book to John, who has no ass at all, William Shatner. So that's an in-joke that only us two understand. Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious. Thank you for sharing that. That's hilarious. Now, I know that you wrote two books, and originally I was going to have you go over both of them, but in interest of saving time because they cut off a half an hour from us, I'll just mention what the one is. The one is, So That's What It Means, The Wise Friend in Your Pocket, and that's the one we're not going to go over. And since you had already mentioned The Other Side of Harry, not as far as the name of the book, which that actually is the name of the book, but you don't have to, well, actually, you can say whatever you like, but I was curious about the screenplay thing. You know, how this is going to be put into an 8-part TV series. But for the listeners that didn't hear, you can give like a brief synopsis of what it's about and then talk about that 8-part TV series.
Okay, thank you. Yes, because of I became an actor and I've been involved in various TV series, and I've been in Star Trek and the Chronicles of Narnia and loads of different things, martial arts movies, I get invited to conventions. And a few years ago, I was at a convention, and I was doing signing a autograph of the picture, and a guy came over to me. He was overweight, and he was sweating profusely. And I looked up at him and said, yeah, who would you like it to? And then he broke down crying. He said to me, it's okay for you. You're an actor and a martial arts expert, but my life's been really difficult. And he cried. And I gave him a hug, and I thought, my God, these people just see me sitting here like an actor, soaking up all this adulation, but they don't know where I came from. I thought, I've got to give this message out here that you know, you don't always start out like this. It doesn't matter how you start up. It's, you know, how you continue your life that's important. So I wrote the book about my family's life story called The Other Side of Harry. As I said, one side of Harry was a lovely, beautiful man. The other side of Harry was this crazed maniac who lived in a world that we couldn't understand at all. The first part of the book opened up, and the saying I'm saying it is, the thing that makes a star shine bright is the darkness that surrounds it. Now, if I hadn't have had such a dark life, because we had police sieges, straitjackets, terrible stuff, if I'd have had such a dark life, I wouldn't have succeeded the way I have. It was my catalyst. And if we can turn that, the pain we go through, into the fuel that makes us succeed, then all the pain is somehow worthwhile. So I wrote this book that chronicled from when my mother and father met right up till literally the present day and all the amazing things I've done. Meeting Gene Roddenberry, I can't even speak, meeting Gene Roddenberry. Gene sat me in his office and he put his hands on my shoulders and said, "What are your ambitions?" And like a Star Trek fan would say, I said, "Well, I'd like to sit in Captain Kirk's chair." And he laughed. And he said, "But what are your life ambitions?" And this was, you know, early 80s, 82. "What are your life ambitions?" And I said, "Well, I wish I'd have been an actor." And he said to me, "Are you dead?" So I said, "No." He said, "Well, why aren't you an actor?" And I said, "Well, I can't act." And then Gene put both his hands on my shoulders, looked in my eyes and said, "If man had only dreamed of walking on the moon, but never taken the steps to get there, we'd be earthbound. If you wish to fly tomorrow, flap your wings today." Then he said, "Let's go and sit in Captain Kirk's chair." And I had an amazing tour of the sets by Richard Arnold, Gene's assistant. And I pushed the button on Captain Kirk's chair that I'd seen on my wall at home all those years ago when we were going through hell as a family. And at the same trip, I said to Richard Arnold, "Richard, Bruce Lee had a school here. Could you take me to this address?" And I went there to Bruce Lee's school, spoke to one of Bruce Lee's friends, a student, did a demonstration, and that put me on the road to being trained by the Bruce Lee people. So that was the way this book is full of inspirational things about impossible is only impossible if you say it's impossible. So this book was published maybe 13 years ago, and all the money from that goes to a mental health charity called Chipmunker. But I still got loads of emails from people around the world saying, "Your book helped me so much. It helped me survive my dark days because you didn't give up. I didn't give up. And that means the world to me." And I thought, wow, if I could do that with a book, what if it was on the screen? It could reach so many more people. So I've spent years and years being involved with different production companies trying to get this made. And now I've teamed up with an amazing man. His name is Dean Drinkell, and he's a multi-award-winning writer, a novel writer, a script writer, a director, and he shares the vision of my book. He loves the story. And so we've finished the pilot episode together. We've written that. Now we're going to do another 7 synopsis of the rest of the series and hopefully pitch it to different companies for an 8-part miniseries called The Other Side of Harry. And because my life was so impossible to go from nothing and fear to being an actor, a stuntman, a bodyguard, a life coach, a martial arts so-called master, I would have done none of those things if I'd have had an easy life. So if anyone out there is going through a hard life now, if you just need, you know, to hang on till the light comes, it always will come again. But if you gave up today, you might have made it tomorrow. So the message of the film and the book is don't give up. And that's what we're trying to do now. Once we complete this and get the sales pitch ready, we may try Netflix, Amazon, all these different streaming services, but that's where we are.
Cool. I hope it happens, and I hope it happens soon, because you deserve that. You deserve to have that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. There wasn't.
I'm sorry. Were you going to say something else?
Sorry, Cheryl. Yes, there was one American company that was very interested in this being made as a series. But because I've spent a load of time in the States training with the Bruce Lee people, making Star Trek, visiting all the Star Trek movie sets, being with Gene Roddenberry, they said, "John, you spent so much time in the States, we think we should make this into an American family. Then the story might make more sense." But the whole point is, coming from the downtrodden part of London where we had no money, no food, no friends, and then going to America and Hollywood was so impossible for someone like me, that was the whole point of the film. And making it an American family would have made it so much easier. But because it was impossible, it proves that nothing is impossible. So I didn't go with the American family idea, and I stuck to my guns, and hopefully people all around the world can identify with my family. No matter what race you are, we all go through terrible dark times. And if you can't, you know, survive till the light comes back, that is the key, never giving in. So that's what my, hopefully, the series will be about, not giving in, and nothing is impossible. Sorry, Cheryl, over to you. I do carry on a bit, don't I?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, you're the guest, so... but the problem is it's not you, it's that Blog Talk Radio doesn't have that good of audio, and so sometimes there's an overlap, and I don't even realize you're still talking when I go to say something. But if you were done now, I was going to start asking you about some of your the things that you've done, and we've got a little under 40 minutes now since they cut off our extra 30 minutes.
Okay.
So I probably won't get to everything, but I'll start with what's on IMDb. Now, the Chronicles of Narnia, that wasn't even on IMDb, so I'm not sure when that was. But I do know that the British Empire, that one was on 1994 to 97, I think. And I know you were in that one. So you can talk about both of those if you want, because they could have been at the same time for all I know.
Yes, well, the both were BBC series. Before the Narnia movies came out, there was a BBC series that was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Then they had, The Dawn Treader, I think it was. Then The Silver Chair. They did all the Chronicles of Narnia by the BBC. And I played in The Silver Chair, one of the Queen of Narnia, the evil queens, one of her lead rock guards, full of makeup and prosthetics. And I filmed it with Tom Baker. Do you know Tom Baker? He was a Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And I filmed that with Tom Baker, amazing man. And that was an amazing privilege. We went on location for months on end and filmed this. So Narnia was fantastic. There was one thing I remember. We were in a place called Peak Caverns, which is a set of caves deep in under the English countryside. And it had an underground lake there. And one scene we had to do was to crawl through this gap in the rocks. You're about 100 feet underground, pitch black with just the lights of where the cameras are going to film. We're going through this tunnel, and I've got these small people in front of me, these dwarfs who are dressed in weird costumes, and I'm dressed in rubber as a rock creature with armor on top of that, which is hard to breathe. You're 100 feet underground, and over the lights that the BBC have put up, and all of a sudden we had a power cut, and you're in pitch darkness, stuck in this tunnel, 100 feet underground, in armor, in rubber, and you can hear yourself like breathe internally. And the panic that could have set in with people, and I started just trying to keep people calm. And Tom Baker was amazing. He was calling out to keep everybody calm, and he was going along the line of people, giving people peppermints and jelly babies, which are sweets, to keep them calm. So that was a memory that will stay with me forever. Tom Baker was quite an amazing person. The other series I did was a comedy series called The Britas Empire. And do you get Red Dwarf in America? You do, don't you? Red Dwarf?
Yeah.
Comedy series called Red Dwarf. And the guy who plays the holographic character, Chris Barry, he plays Mr. Britas. And it was based in a sports center. And it ran for quite a few seasons. And I had a character called Patrick. So that was my association with the BBC. It ran for quite a few years. So with Narnia and the British Empire, it's great to get a regular check. You know, any actor wants to be in a series that lasts. So once that series ends, you go, now what do I do? So luckily, I've always had my other string to my bow, which is the martial arts.
Well, yeah, that would help to have that regular paycheck. But it would be nice if it could be with acting all the time. But, you know, what are you going to do? You got to make money. Now, I'm going to fast forward, and if we have time, I'll come back to some of the other ones. But I wanted to get to some of the Star Trek stuff, so I'm going to pass over some of this stuff. So in 2007 or thereabouts, you did Star Trek of Gods and Men. And you acted in it, and plus you did the costumes as well. Now, I've seen that movie, and I know lots of people that were involved in it, you know, you included, and it's a great, great movie. And so I'd like you to talk about it, give the people who haven't seen it a short synopsis, and then talk about your experience doing it.
Yeah, well, that came about when I played Captain Karg, the lead Klingon in Star Trek New Voyages. They were on those wonderful sets I told you that James Coley built. Now, when those episodes mm-hmm. started to get on the internet, a guy saw them, and his name was Sky Conway. And he'd written, he got a guy called Jack Trevino, who'd written some episodes of Deep Space Nine, and he'd written this wonderful thing called Star Trek of Gods and Men. Now, I had a phone call one day from Walter Koenig, my friend Walter. Walter was going to be in Of Gods and Men, and he said, John, there's going to be a great part in this for you. Could you fly over and do this? Nichelle Nichols was in it. Tim Russ was in it. Tim Russ was directing it. Garrett Wang, Herb Jefferson from Battlestar Galactica, and it carried on and on and on. All these different people from different science fiction genres. So the premise of it is that the Guardian of Forever, the future's been changed. So it's a very dark future. And Chekhov is like a renegade. And Starfleet has been taken over. You know, the Klingons are in Starfleet and everything else. So it's an amazing adventure. And I have to play... I played lots of stunt Klingons, but my Klingon, the main part, prisoners escaped from a cell, which is Nichelle Nichols, Walter Koenig, Garrett Wang. They escape and they round this corner in the Enterprise, and there I am with my full Klingon ridge head, and we call it the chair wig, so I've got a big curly-headed wig on. The makeup was amazing, and I have to question them, you know, where are you going? How did you get out? And all this stuff. And I have quite a lot of dialogue. Tim Russ, I know him, we've been out for dinner together, but he's a very tough director, and he'd never met me before. And pardon me using a swear word, but when I first met Tim, he said, buddies, your shit together. And that was my introduction to Tim. I said, yes, Tim, my shit's together. So I got through this load of dialogue in front with Nichelle Nichols, Walter Koenig, you know, all these great people I've grown up with on Star Trek. And just so I get to the end of my dialogue, Walter is supposed to pull out a phaser and kill me. Because he's my dear friend, he pulls out the phaser, puts it between my legs and fires it as a joke. And he's laughing his head off. And I went, oh, you, no. You know, and he said, well, John, I thought you'd be happy. I went, oh. So we had to go and read through the entire scene. Luckily, I got through it again. And this time he shot me and killed me for real. So the premise of it, really, history's been changed. And the Federation is very dark, and they're about to become renegades who's good in the Federation. At the end of it, it gets put back to the way it should be. So everything's set right. And the amount of names you see in this from all the different eras of Star Trek is incredible, and various science fiction programs. That led, again, Jack Trevino did another script, which was called Star Trek Renegades. And this was, the production values, again, was stepped up from Of Gods and Men. And Walter gave me another call. John, there's another thing, Star Trek Renegades. There's two parts I think you'd be great for. So I went over, auditioned, and I got two parts. One was the only Klingon you see in the entire thing. And the other part was a Starfleet admiral who they tried to assassinate. And again, the cast list was amazing. Sean Young was in that, the beautiful girl who played Rachel in Blade Runner. She was in it. And to work with all these iconic people... yeah, amazing. So the second one we did was Star Trek Renegades. Sorry, carry on. Over to you, Cheryl.
Oh, no, not at all, because actually I was going to bring up Star Trek Renegades, so you just segued into that very nicely. So if you've got anything else to say about Renegades, go right ahead.
Yes, there's some great stories, behind-the-scenes stories. I played the Gary Graham, who was in Alien Nation. He was also in Star Trek of Gods and Men, and he was in Star Trek Renegades. He plays a shapeshifter. Now, in this episode, I play a Starfleet Admiral. You see me as me, as the Starfleet Admiral. But then this shapeshifter called Ragnar, he shapeshifts into a Klingon, but he's still Ragnar. And he speaks differently to some Klingons. He uses language they wouldn't. In a scene, he's on the view screen with Starfleet to say, the Klingon has to say, can you not see my pulchritudinous face? Which means, Can you not see my beauteous face? Okay. Klingons wouldn't really say pulchritudinous. Now, I'd read the script. Everything's ready. They put the Klingon teeth in me. You try saying pulchritudinous with Klingon teeth. I couldn't do it. Can you not see my face? Oh, God, I couldn't do it. So it took me back, and they blacked my own teeth up so I could do the lines, which was fine, but you can't just clean the stuff off. You have to scrape it off afterwards, which is not much fun. So we got through the pulchritudinous face parts, and then I thought, wow, I've got through this scene. I've done it great. Tim Russ comes up to me and says, right, now you're not Ragnar. You're the real Klingon who Ragnar made out to be, and they forgot to give me the dialogue, even forgot to give me any of the pages. So there and then I had to suddenly learn these pages, and that is when pressure is really on. What I've noticed on Hollywood productions, LA big productions, when you're not being used, you're sort of invisible. Everyone does their job and carries on, and you watch like an outsider watching in. But when it's your turn, the spotlight hits you, and the pressure is boom, you better get this right because time is money, and you feel the weight of it. So unless you preparation meets opportunity, success begins. So luckily I was prepared, and my buddy Walter Koenig, every time we finished the scene, he'd come and sit in my lap between takes, which was so sweet and nice. But I never had the, Walter, you're sitting on Klingon's lap. Yeah, so we're really like brothers. It's wonderful. So Star Trek Renegades was a really great production. I learned a lot about Hollywood productions by watching, just sitting there and watching these amazing people. You know, Herb Jefferson, again, was in this. Amazing man. And Eddie Furler, I think his name is, he played young John Connor in Terminator.
Yes.
So he was in this. He hadn't done anything for years because he'd had problems, drugs and whatever. And this was the first work he'd done in years. And when I got to meet Sean Young, I thought she was beautiful in Blade Runner. And I didn't have any scenes with her, but I'm thinking, right, I wonder where she is. Is she on the set? And between takes, I went to the refrigerator and I took a carton of milk. And I walked outside, the dusk was just coming down, just getting dark, and I took a swig of this milk, and it was off. It was rancid. And I turned around to spit it out, and in front of me was Sean Young. She went, oh, hi, you're the Brit. So you have to swallow the milk and hope. So, yeah, I swallowed sour milk for Sean Young.
That's hilarious.
Glamorous, isn't it?
And she probably had no idea.
No, and I thought, no. Thank God, I don't have any kissing scenes with the lady. But, yeah. Well, I suppose my breath would have smelled like Klingon breath, really, wouldn't it? Yeah, it would
have. I guess.
Yeah,
that's why I like to hear funny stories.
Yeah, life's too short, and at the moment the world's in a pretty dark place, isn't it? So we need some laughter.
Yeah, we most definitely do. Now, you had already talked some about the Star Trek New Voyages, so you don't have to say too much more about it. But for anybody that might be listening or that's going to listen to the taped version, I just wanted them to know how much you really did on that series, because you were makeup artist, you were producer, stunt coordinator, and you acted in it. And so just shortly, since you already talked about it, tell us, you know, what kind of an experience it was doing more than just acting in this series.
Yeah, well, my main job on that was, as one of the lead characters, I came in 7 episodes, Captain Karg, the lead Klingon, who returned time again to menace Captain Kirk. But I only helped with props. My wife, who I brought over with me for an episode, she used to be a seamstress. She was a costumer. And they got her making some uniforms. So I didn't really do the uniforms. My wife did a lot of the uniforms. And the Klingon heavy double episode called Katumba, we made, I think, 16 Klingon uniforms in England and brought them over with us. Classic Klingon. So she did some amazing work. And in one episode, there was going to be an Andorian, a blue Andorian. And the person, the guy who was going to be the Andorian, didn't turn up. So I said to my wife, do you know something? You could do this. You've got such a sassy attitude, because my wife's quite sassy. Could you be the Andorian? So she got made up by a chap called Kevin Haney. He got an Oscar for Driving Miss Daisy. and Kevin Haney was the makeup man. Amazing, amazing man. So all the people that got thrown on the voyages were people who worked in the industry, like Doug Drexler, created my character, Karg.
Yeah.
But he couldn't let Paramount know because he was working on Star Trek at the time. And Mike and Denise Okuda used to supply stuff for Star Trek New Voyages, but Paramount couldn't know because they were working on Star Trek at the time. So it was a very professional group of people and kept being called back time and time again to be Captain Karg. And all the fight scenes, there was one episode where the Klingons ridgeheads fight the smooth heads and the Federation together. And we had one big fight scene. I think there was over 30 people in one big room fighting with bat lefts and swords and kicks and punches and headbutts. So I sent over all these tapes on a disc, loads of copies, and said, could you pass these out? It's me with my martial arts class rehearsing all the fight scenes for the episode. When I got over there, they hadn't passed anything out. They had 3 months to do it and hadn't done it. So I had to rehearse day and night with all the cast to get all these fight scenes done, as well as all the other stuff. But Star Trek New Voyages was renamed as Star Trek New Voyages / Phase 2. And there was quite a few episodes done, and the production values were amazing. And when the series wasn't picked up, that's now those sets, and now the Star Trek original series set tour in Ticonderoga. It was one of my best parts I enjoy doing, because Captain Karg, my character, one of the smooth-head Klingons, you could be very Machiavellian, you could be very subtle. When you've got the makeup with the ridge heads on, you have to be very much like that. But Karg was very Machiavellian and a very deep-thinking Klingon. And you can't always play evil. You can't just twiddle your moustache and play evil, because even the most evil people think they're doing right. So you have to play truth. Yeah?
Well, yeah, they have their reasons, and unless they're true evil, and there's very few of those, and I'm talking about in the movies, there's very few that are true evil.
Yes.
But they always have a reason, and they think that they're doing the right thing. Even Khan, you know, in The Wrath of Khan.
Absolutely.
He took that as doing the right thing because Kirk was responsible for his wife dying, and...
Yes.
You know, he was responsible for all those people dying, Kirk was, because he left them there. He never checked up on them or anything. So, on the one hand, Khan was right. He was responsible.
Yeah, he felt totally justified for his vengeance. Yeah. And talking about wives, my wife, who did lots of the costuming, they wrote a part for her. And I gave a drama training for months and months. And she became Captain Karg's first officer, called Liak. And she was in several episodes, and she got quite a following herself, because my character Karg was always larger than life. His delivery was very much like Yul Brynner in The King and I. Everything he did was a pose.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught Annie to play under my character. She was very matter-of-fact with everything. And she did it very well. She played evil very well, which says a lot about my wife.
Yeah, that's very cool.
I'll say no more.
Oh, that's very nice. Not that you're saying that she's evil, because you're saying her character was evil. I understand that. Some
and
people may not understand.
Yeah, second
go ahead.
She got the makeup on, she became Liak, and she didn't have to try, which was great. She just let it happen naturally, and that's. The art of acting is not to be caught doing it, if you get what I mean. And that's the key to it. She was so naturalistic with it. You know, you've got Shakespearean acting, which is over the top. You've got naturalistic acting, which is, you know, or you've got slightly heightened. Star Trek was always slightly heightened. That's why a lot of people have, you know, moaned about William Shatner. He was larger than life, but that's why we love Captain Kirk, because there's only one Captain Kirk.
And actually, I know people that talk and project themselves like what Captain Kirk did. I know of a couple of people like that, so it's not like it was so far out there that it was crazy.
No, I think leadership and belief. He believed in himself, and you drew the strength from Kirk. And when Kirk spoke, you listened. And even the gaps between his words spoke volumes, didn't they? You hung on every word he said. Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I did want to ask you about Cowboy Creed. Now,
mm-hmm.
I've seen that. It's a very good one. It's a short.
Thanks.
And you acted and, of course, did the fight coordinating in that. So if you
mm-hmm.
just want to go ahead and tell the listeners about that one.
Yes, thank you, Cheryl. A guy who did second unit directing on Star Trek Phase 2, a great young director called Ben Alpi. Ben remembered me as Karg, and he brought a great performance out of me and my evil wife. And he wrote a script called Cowboy Creed. And it was based back in the Western days on the railroads. And his idea was that an Englishman, an English aristocrat, had to flee England because he'd done something wrong. And he went on the Silk Road of China for 10 years and picked up certain skills. And then went back to America and preyed on the gold rush. And he robbed the trains and stuff. And I played the character called Limey, who was that aristocrat who went back and preyed on the trains. And a bit like Khan, really, my character's wife got killed in a shootout. The sheriff followed him to a log cabin, and you hear that his wife was killed in the crossfire. And I vowed vengeance, like Khan did with Kirk. Limey vowed vengeance mm-hmm. on the sheriff's family. And they didn't have enough money to film the whole film. So it's an amazing script. So you film a portion of it, show this to backers, to get the rest of the money. So that we did a 20-minute portion of it, and it picks up when my character, Limey, has shot the sheriff he's not killed him, but shot him in the chest. He's not dead, but he's kidnapped his daughter. And the sheriff's young deputy is in love with the daughter, and he goes off to rescue her. And Limey confronts him. And there's lots of martial arts action in it, because Limey fights differently to a cowboy, because he's picked up all these different skills. And I was so impressed that just for a 20-minute portion of a film, the amount of care and love that went into everything to make it authentic. We went up into Santa Clarita, up into the mountains, and there was an amazing stunt coordinator there called Anthony DeLongis, and he was in Roadhouse, and he did loads of movies. You see him in everything. He played Masters of the Universe. He was the weapons expert in that. And I choreographed all the fight scenes with my martial arts people over here, sent the footage across so they could see what I was going to do. And when I got over there, I didn't know Anthony DeLongis was on the production. But he was so gracious and said, John, all your choreography is great. If I have any suggestions, I'll let you know. And Anthony played the sheriff, and we did this amazing, amazing shoot just for 3 days up in the mountains. And at one point, I showed my naivety. I'm standing there in the middle of this canyon. I said to Ben, why is this canyon called Snake Canyon? And he said, well, you see those people, there's three of them standing up on different hillsides. I said, yeah. He said, they're looking for snakes because this is Snake Canyon. And I went, good grief. So I'd wandered off a while before and just sightseeing around all the rocks and things, and I wasn't even thinking about snakes. So it was an amazing shoot, burning hot in the day, freezing cold in the evening. But Cowboy Creed was fantastic. And if we get the chance to do the rest of the film, that would be an amazing thing if I could do that. But yep, Limey, us English are always bad guys. Do you notice? Whenever we're in American films or anything, we're always the bad guys. Because I think we do it so well, a touch of evil.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're good at it, that's what they're going to have you do.
There you go.
And playing the bad guy is more fun.
Yeah, it is. Oh, yeah, because you get to let rip,
Yeah, because you don't have to worry about being nice to the other person.
There you go.
Well, to the actor, yeah, but not to the other character.
Yeah, the trust I was given was amazing because we didn't get time for rehearsals or anything. And you're kicking and punching across someone's face and headbutts and everything. And you've got to have this rapport and trust. And if you haven't got that, that's why you've got to be professional. And you know that
right.
If you don't trust the people with you, it's not going to work. Yeah.
Oh, you're exactly right. Now, one of the ones I wanted to ask you about, of course, because it's newer, and we've got like 15 minutes left now, Humber City, The Rising Tide, that's like a TV movie. Now, according to IMDb, it's still in post-production. I don't know. I'm just going by what they say. But you acted, you were co-producer, I think, and again, you were the fight choreographer. Now, I do know some things about this, but for the listeners, tell us like a synopsis of what it is and what it was like working on this.
Yeah, well, it's been in production for several years now, because this is a company that hasn't got the budget sorted and everything else. They get money and try and film a piece of it when they can and go back to it. So all the cast are slowly getting older, so continuity is going to be a problem. I had the lead character in this. His name's McGavin. And again, he's a policeman, but he's got so much darkness in him that he walks the line between light and dark. So you never know if he's one or the other. And again, he thinks he's justified, but he's overly violent. He's overly pushy in all the scenes. We filmed some great stuff, but the writer, director, he has done three pilots using all of us, and he didn't want to use any of these pilots. So we're slowly going, I think we've done enough now. Over 7 years, we've done three pilots, and you're not actually putting any of those to the networks. Then something is, you know, got to give. So I'm not sure if we're ever going to see Humber City, but it gave me a chance again to be dark as well as light. It walks, what I like about this script, this McGavin guy has obviously got something in his past that makes him not want to have any chinks in his armor. So he overcompensates. He makes sure no one questions him. He makes sure he always comes in with the strongest response no matter what the situation is. It's got some great cast members in it with us. And I've got some of my American friends involved and some of the effects people from the States. But I'm not sure it will ever see the light of day because, you know, after several years, I think the cast are all losing faith. But Humber City, it was a great thing to do, great experience, but I'm not sure you'll ever get to see it, unfortunately.
Yeah, that would be a shame because it does sound like it's going to be good if they would, you know, finish it. And I understand the money thing because I have quite a few filmmaker friends, and there's one, I won't say the name or anything because I think what I'm going to say might offend him, but he's been working on this thing for a few years now, and he's had the crowdfunding thing, and some people, not all, but some are getting upset with him because they put money into this and they're not seeing anything in return. And I've even gotten on some of these forums and said, well, it does take sometimes years to make movies. Even the big budget movies can take several years to make. And sometimes they'll leave them and go back 5, 6, even 10 years later. And that's the big budget ones. So if that can happen on a big budget one, it can happen on a low or no budget one. But I doubt if this one will see the light of day either. I'm hoping it does, but I don't think it's going to. And that's why I didn't want to say the name because, you know, I don't want him to get mad at me. So
that's very, very gracious of you because people pour their hearts into these things. And an actor wants, producer wants to produce. And it's
right.
No one's fault. It's circumstances. You know, that's why the other side of Harry's series, we're not going to crowdfund for this. We're going to do it properly because it spans from 1957 to the present day. So it's going to be a heck of a production. And unless you can do it justice, I'm not going to do it, but we're going to do it justice.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to that because I think that's going to be really good. It's something that people need to see. People need to see that. I've got a friend that has mental issues, and he was asking me, actually just yesterday, he was asking me if he could be on my show and talk about his mental issues. And I said, sure. I said, I said over and over, you don't have to be a celebrity to be on my show. All you need is something to talk about and a phone. That's all you need to be on my show.
To give someone a voice
is a great
gift.
Yes. Yes. Well, we do have like 10 minutes, so I think we can go over at least one more of your things going back to like 2014. Because this one sounded interesting to me, Z-listers, because I did look it up and read the synopsis and everything.
That's good.
So, Yeah, so tell the listeners about Z-Listers and what that was like working on that one.
Well, that was a great, great production, actually. And it strikes a chord with me because I've been a guest at maybe 24 conventions, I should think, over the years, because my involvement with science fiction series and Star Trek and Narnia, all these different things. And sometimes you go to the conventions and you see someone there. Now, I'm not putting these people down because everyone needs to make a living or get their 15 minutes of fame. But you see someone there who is maybe a stormtrooper in an episode of Star Trek. In a Star Wars film, they were six trooper from the left. And there they are signing because they were in Star Wars, but you never got to see their face or anything. So the name of this film was Z-Listers because you got your A-lister stars or your B-lister. These are the Z-lister stars that appear at conventions, and so that's the premise of the film. And it's a guy who, the story was a guy who was in Doctor Who many years ago as a child. He makes his entire living out of going to these conventions with his child photographs and saying, this was who I was, you know, 25 years ago. So that's his entire living. He's a Z-lister. And I play a man from the BBC who... He gets called into the BBC thinking he's going to get a part in something, and instead the BBC try and claim all this back money from him that he's owed for all the pictures he sold of him in the BBC series. So that's why it's called Z-Listers. And it was a good cast, and they actually filmed at these conventions and signings to get some stock footage. So some of the fans in it are real fans. And it's a comedy, but with a really good message. That, you know, even if someone's a Z-lister, as they say, they should never call people Z-listers. You know, everyone is someone. But at the end of it, this guy realizes that he can't make his living out of something he did 25 years ago. You know, time's moved on, and you have to move with the times and make new mountains to climb. So Z-listers was a really good part, but I play this nasty BBC man again. See that word again, Mr. Nasty, a Klingon nasty, Limey nasty, McGavin nasty, and BBC nasty. But I did do a thing called Advanced Warriors where I was the hero. And I was with Chase Masterson, who was from Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and Jeremy Bullock, mm-hmm. who was Boba Fett from Star Wars. But I had the lead part in that. And I was the hero. Yay!
Oh, wow! Yeah, but I still think I would like to call you Mr. Nasty.
Oh, thank you so much, Cheryl. I'm glad I'm not in the same room. You'd find out if I was nasty or not.
Oh, you know, it would only be for fun because you're like the farthest thing from nasty that I've ever seen. I mean, I've never met you.
You've seen my post on Facebook. I know. It's all acting.
Go ahead.
The thing that I tend to get cast with, because of the dark past with my dad and what we went through and the violence and everything else, I find it easy to play dark. Because inside me there is this dark place, you know, from the pain from years ago, which I've learned to use and leave behind, but I can switch into darkness very easy. If I have to laugh on film, I find that real acting, you know? But to play darkness, mm-hmm. I find easier. Not because I'm evil or anything, but because I've been there so often when I was young, you know? Well, that's really the thing down, isn't it?
No, not at all. And I can empathize somewhat, and not entirely. I won't go into it too much because, you know, this is your show, but I had a father that wasn't a nice man, and he was physically, mentally, and emotionally abusive and was always telling all of his children that they would never amount to anything. And for a long time, we all believed that. And one time in my life, I was trying to be a nurse. And I said, you know what? I'm going to do this if only to prove Dad wrong. And I did it. And that's the reason why I did it, to prove him wrong.
That goes back to the thing that makes a star shine bright is the darkness that surrounds it. Now, you're on
exactly.
the phone. You'll be listened to by thousands, if not more, people. So what would he say to this? There you go. Congratulations.
Yeah, he was not nice. Some people, like my sister, my one sister, they try to make excuses for him because he, and there, she's right on one hand. He was in World War II, and he did suffer what we now call PTSD, which they used to call shell shock. And he wasn't the same after he came back, after the terrible things that he saw. Because he spent a lot of time in the European theater and during the war, and he saw a lot of gruesome things. Yeah, and so of course people aren't going to be the same when they come back from that. But he had the opportunity to get help with the GI Bill, and he just didn't do it. It wouldn't have cost him anything. They offered it to him. He had an honorable discharge. There was nothing wrong with his record. They just knew that he had problems, and so they wanted him to get help, and they told him to, and he never did. And that's how he ended up like he did, because he didn't get help.
I'm not saying this is describing your father, but some people would rather moan about the darkness than light a candle. And that's it.
Yes.
And it can be your choice. And to say, I failed because my past... You could just as, you know, it takes more strength, but to say I succeeded because of my past, you know, and that's what you're doing, and that's what I tried to do. And if we can inspire some people who are listening to this not to give up and to make those stumbling blocks into stepping stones, that's job done.
Yeah, I totally agree. And now, because they cut us for our time, we're down to like 3 minutes, so normally I try to ask my guest to tell listeners, what is the best way to contact you?
Well, if you go to my website, johncarrigan.com, or you can join me on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, you can friend request me. I've also got John Carrigan actor page on Facebook. So they would probably be the best ways to contact me, johncarrigan.com, or find me on Facebook. You know, never be afraid to talk to me about anything, because unless we can help each other, then the world's a sad place. So that's what I'm here for.
Well, yeah, that's what I was alluding to earlier, that, you know, I was joking when I said, you know, Mr. Nasty, I'm going to enjoy calling you Mr. Nasty, only because it's a complete opposite of what you are. I've never seen you be anything but sweet to people. And every time I've talked to you, you're like the sweetest guy. Well, maybe not the sweetest, but one of the sweetest guys that I've ever talked to. So, yeah, no way that you're nasty.
Well, thank you so much.
Other
that means
than, yeah, other than when you're acting. So we're down to almost like 90 seconds. So is there anything that you want to say in closing?
Well, really, just that, send me all your best vibes for me to get this series made with my friend Dean Drinkle, because we're going to make The Other Side of Harry to help people survive their darkest times. And hopefully you'll find it fascinating and interesting. Boldly go, Cheryl.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm looking forward to whatever else you do, because you always are good, no matter what you do, good guy or bad guy, you're always good. And I look forward to everything else that you're going to be posting on Facebook. I always enjoy the stuff that you post. So, John Carrigan, thank you for being on the show, and hopefully you might want to come back sometime, since we had a little trouble this time. And have a good night.
Well, same to you, and stay safe, everybody. The light will come again.
Thank you. Yeah, you be safe as well. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.